Okay. Being a first day of the session, we'll start with the Cohen Moo again. I'll read out the case, very short case. The monk asked Joshua in all earnestness, "Does a dog have Buddha nature or not?" And Joshua answers, "Moo." Some of you are working on Moo. Some of you have been working on Moo and had a breakthrough through Moo. And all of us are continuing to work on Moo. As we mentioned in the introduction yesterday, the primary purpose of this session, of having a session like this in general, is to access, to discover in many ways, because we, for some of us, we haven't discovered it yet, our true nature. And I'd like to talk a little bit about this. What does that mean to discover our true nature? So, first of all, every koan is a mu koan. There's just different words for mu. And in order to really understand this, intellectual understanding is just not sufficient. We think it is, but in many ways it is not, and it shows up in Dokusan when you can't show it. We can explain it, and some of us can explain it really well, but when it comes to showing it, being it, it eludes us as if there's two different things. So this session is about really connecting again, over and over again, with Mu. Connecting with our essential nature. Mu is just another word for it, connecting with our essential nature. And it's a little bit like looking at the big picture, looking at the big picture of it. I remember when I was in business, once a year we had this meeting with our accountant, and in many ways I dreaded it because I really didn't want to know what it was, what the big picture was. I was far more interested in the intricate details of the business than the big picture. But every time after I had this meeting with the accountant, looking at the big picture, I felt relief. All of a sudden, it started making sense. Why am I in business? Why am I doing all of this? What's the purpose? Am I going the right direction? I could see things clearly or more clearly. So this is the same, in any organization. Doesn't matter whether it is a government organization or an institution or a business organization or even a sangha. It is really important. Or the other thing is our life. Our life is an organization, or it's an organ. We look at it. We have a family. We have, the context of our life, if you like. You can even compare it to that. So looking at the big picture of it is quite important. Because we get trapped in the small details. And so what happens is, like when you look at, for instance, even such a big institution like a hospital, we might get trapped, or people get trapped in procedures, in processes, and we forget that we don't have enough beds, and there's ramping happening outside the door. And then all that effort is put into procedures and forms and formulations to the extent that, 80, 90% of the work that we do is all process related and not actual care related. So looking at the big picture, even in our own life, is really important to just get perspective again. What is it actually that I'm doing? Am I Life goes so fast. The time passes so fast that it's really healthy to just have a look and take a step back. And Sesshin is one of those times. Now, I don't mean some of those times where we look at our life and we start analyzing it like you would in a business. But from a spiritual point of view, from a spiritual point of view, we are looking at the core of what it means to be alive, what it means to actually live, what it means to have relationships. So, and that core is what we're here to uncover, because it's always there, but we get lost in processes and procedures. And to remind ourselves that that matters a great deal, and hopefully to integrate whatever insights we get so that we don't lose sight of the most important part of our life. So some of you have had an experience of essential nature, but that's in the past. That's gone. That's why Kensho is important. And yes, we have got a reference point, but it needs to be rediscovered over and over and over again. It cannot be any separate than whatever is happening right now. Right now, this second, is where it's happening. Not what happened at a previous session or what happened when we had a previous moment. It is right now. To what degree? To what degree am I seeing it? To what degree am I immersed in it all, rather than lost in processes and procedures and meaning and purpose, all these things that can cloud the picture. So what's holding us back? I've asked that question many times on this koan, with this particular koan. And I came up with I heard a new word the other day, and I thought, oh, that's a good word to mention. And that is selfing. And we know about selfies, taking a selfie. But selfing is like, I used the word self-referencing. But selfing is in many ways what holds us back. Self-referencing is our stuckness in looking at our surroundings and looking at our life from this perspective of self. I don't mean by that selfishness. I mean, selfishness is another thing again. Selfishness is when we get so absorbed in self, and in many ways it is selfishness is a mechanism by which we protect ourselves because we have some sort of need to put self before others. That is selfish. We have a need to somehow protect the self or advance the self. So we are in many ways wired that way, depending on the conditioning that we had in life. So selfishing can be positive and it can be negative. We are all selfish to some degree. We cannot help it simply to survive. We need to somehow look after ourselves. So that is not what I mean, and this is not what is meant by self-referencing or selfing. What is meant by selfing or by self-referencing is that we look at the world from the notion of self and other. That's a completely different thing. And this is where we get stuck in this notion of self, from self and other. So I can be very generous, but still stuck in selfing. I can be still stuck in looking at things from this, we call it dualism. You heard me many, many times mentioning the word dualism. So I can be stuck there in selfing, be very generous, do all the right thing according to whatever precepts I follow, but still stuck. So here we have this koan. And a koan is a mechanism, it is a tool to be able to get unstuck, to unstuck ourselves from this perspective, from this paradigm that we sit in, which we call self and which we call other. So every koan, of course, as it says in the introduction of Mumon that you would have heard many times before, except those that are new, you know, every koan presents us a barrier that gives us an opportunity to look at where we are stuck and to unstuck ourselves. But when we look at this koan, it says, a monk asks Joshua in all earnestness, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? First of all, this is a key point. What is Buddha? What is Buddha? Of course, and what is Buddha nature? And most of us cannot see Buddha. In fact, I would say all of us cannot see Buddha. It's just a term, a phrase that we're using. It's very hard not to fall into dualistic concepts when we use language, which is based on dualism. But all of us cannot see Buddha. Why? Because everything is Buddha. So when you look at Buddha, the word Buddha, you know, depending on, again, the way we look at the definition of Buddha, we have all different, we attach different meanings to Buddha. It doesn't actually matter what word you use, but Buddha here in the koan, we are intimate with the koan, so we use the language of the koan as much as possible. So here the word is Buddha. Buddha, of course, as you all know, means awakened, awakening. So the Buddha, his name was the Buddha, you know, the historical Buddha, if you like. His name was Shakyamuni. There's many Buddhas, of course, but this one that we're referring to generally in our tradition, the last Buddha, his name was Shakyamuni. He was just an ordinary person, just like you and I. And he awakened, and then he became known as the Buddha. He awakened to the true self, to who he was beyond the label of Shakyamuni. So he became known as the Buddha. So what is Buddha? So we can say awakening. What's awakening? And so it goes on. We can just ask that question on and on and on ad infinitum. Or we can just keep on asking that question. What is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? We just get another answer. Just get another answer. We might eventually fall silent. That's just another answer. So, what is Buddha? Now, all of you are very well read. You've read a lot about Buddhism. You've heard many Tay shows. You've watched the lectures. You all know intellectually that everything is Buddha. So, why is it that you don't get it? It's the simplest and at the same time the hardest to get unstuck in this. So if I say everything is Buddha, everything is Buddha, is Buddha, Buddha is Buddha. The lovely breeze that I can sense behind me is Buddha. The sounds of the birds are Buddha. Our loved ones are Buddha. My hand, my watch, time. Everything is Buddha. Now, when I say everything is Buddha, I don't mean everything. It's just everything. It's just a word. Everything. That is Buddha. The meaning of everything still implies that there is a thing. Everything. There's still a thing there. If there is a thing there, how can that all, if everything is Buddha, how can there be a thing? And that is where we get stuck. How can there be a thing? How can there be mu? How can there be me? How can there be, if you really get it, the only other word that is close to it is all. Buddha is all. And of course, we all, you know, you heard me many times talk about it, and not just me, but many teachers. You know, the other reference point is I alone, meaning aloneness, no other. It's just alone. That's another word for it. Just alone. even I is superfluous. So all. And the reason there is no Buddha, or that we can't see Buddha, let me put it this way, is because as soon as I see it, I'm trapped. There's an I that sees something. So that this is the hard part of this koan. It's to be able to see all. So those of you that are working on Mu, in many ways we are looking for something. And as long as you're on that journey, you're going to Melbourne when really you want to go to Cairns. You're completely going in the opposite direction. That is why we say you have got to melt into it so that you completely disappear. And when that disappearance has happened, it's just there. It arises by itself. There's no, it arises, it doesn't arise. It doesn't really matter what you call it. It is just there. So here we have a koan, this monk asked Joshua. Joshua, of course, he's one of the most famous masters in in the Zen history, compared to Buddha himself, to the Buddha himself. So this monk asked in all earnestness, he's very serious, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? So first of all, the monk would know what Buddha nature is intellectually, but he hasn't really understood Buddha. Or if he has, then he's just testing Joshua to see what, we don't really know whether he has. But presumably because he asked that question, you could say he doesn't know, because otherwise why would he ask that question, except maybe to test Joshua, to see if Joshua sees it. So Joshua, even though he says no, Mu, his answer is Mu. Does a dog have Buddha nature or no? Even though Joshua says Mu, which means no, it does not mean yes or no. It's yes or no. It means you have something. You fall back into this. If everything is Buddha, there can be no, there is nothing that is separate. It cannot be separated by yes or no. So Buddha nature, interestingly, just a little bit on that, Buddha nature, is like when you look at all phenomena, by the way, another word for phenomena is dharma, or dharma nature. You could say dharma nature. So another word for phenomena is the dharma. So dharma, lowercase d, and also means the teaching. Teaching is also a phenomena. Capital D meaning the way it is, coming back to Buddha. But lowercase d, the dharma. So dharma nature is, this is the sutta, like we are chanting Gatha on opening the dharma. The dharma is opening. Gatha on opening the dharma, on opening the teachings. But dharma also means, in not just in Buddhism, in other traditions, phenomena. So does a dog is phenomena. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? So that's the question. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Of course, the monk would know. Everyone knows this, especially if you're a monk, because you would know your Buddhism. You would know the basics. And the basic, in the sutra, it says that everything has Buddha nature. All is Buddha nature. Another way, all is Buddha nature is a better way of looking at it. All is Buddha nature. So to say then, does a dog have Buddha nature, is a ridiculous statement. It really is. It's a ridiculous statement. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? If you see it, you can see the ridiculousness of this statement. And instead of answering intellectually and explaining it to the monk, Joshua answers Mu. And this becomes our task, to discover or to realize or rediscover or to access the world of Mu. What what is this mu? And this is the purpose of this session. It's the purpose of our Zen practice all the time. But here we have got 2 days to immerse ourselves, to completely let go of all of our worldly affairs as much as we can. And the way we let go of our worldly affairs is simply by concentrating on mu. And this is what Mumon's commentary is on about, so I'll talk about that. So here we have Mumon, who is the compiler of the Mumon Khan, the Gateless Gate, it's also called. He compiled all these different sayings from the various masters in the 12th century, even though the sayings date back to Tang Dynasty China, so all the way from 6th century to about 8th, 9th century. He compiled them, and he's inviting us through every koan to somehow access that world of mu through language. Language inherently is dualistic, but only if we see it that way. So let me read out Mumon's commentary. For the practice of Zen. Now, Zen, of course, means meditation. So for the practice of Zazen, sitting meditation, or Kin Hin, walking meditation, or eating meditation, or sleeping meditation, in this context here, in this assembly, and in this time frame that we have, 2 weeks, everything is Zen. Everything is meditation. Please look at it that way. There is no separation. We separate by saying sitting and standing and walking. There is no separation. All mu. And the only way we can truly say this and mean that is if we keep on concentrating on mu 24/7. Because then you've got nothing else but mu. The fact that you're walking is just a label. It's just another label for mu. Eating is just another label for mu. Sleeping is just another label for mu. It's just mu, mu, mu. For the practice of Zen, you must pass the barrier set up by the ancient masters of Zen. To attain to marvelous enlightenment, you must completely extinguish all thoughts of the ordinary mind. So extinguish all thoughts. There's different ways of looking at that. If you concentrate on mu, 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 no other thought comes in. If another thought comes in, you're not concentrating on mu. You are letting another thought creep in. As soon as another thought takes over from mu, which happens all the time in our sitting practice, we have allowed this thought to dominate our practice rather than mu. So letting go is nothing other than concentration. Concentration on mu. That is the practice of letting go. Just to say, let go, doesn't work. What does that even mean, to let go? To let go is to concentrate fully on your object of concentration, mu. For those of you that are already more advanced, you know that when you're eating, it's nothing other than mu. Just concentrate on eating. When you are concentrating on putting the bowls together without noise, concentrate on that. It's just mu. And while you are concentrating, no other thought creeps in. If another thought creeps in, that's because we are not trained enough, that we haven't cultivated our practice enough to be able to fully concentrate on whatever it's doing, whatever we are doing right now. So the other way of looking at that, to completely extinguish all thoughts of the ordinary mind, is to, so again, what is a thought? Thought is nothing other than phenomena. It's just a thought. So when we have a thought coming in, which happens all the time, it's not the enemy. It's just a thought. Don't think all of a sudden that thinking is not allowed. You can't help it. Thoughts will come in. It's a process that happens. We are sitting, no matter how much effort we put into move, thoughts will come in. And depending on how busy our lives are, and depending on how busy we've engaged our mind, these thought processes will come in. And if we have lots of disturbing things happening in our lives, those things will interfere in our practice because we're not relaxed, because there's a lot of stuff happening and those thoughts will creep in. Now, when it says here, extinguish all thoughts of the ordinary mind, there is now a way where if you realize that those thoughts are nothing other than mind formations based on conditionings that have happened in the past, then that's just it. That's just nothing other than mu. These are just mind formations. But of course, we attach to them. We get emotionally attached to them. We want to reject them because they might trigger something negative in us. We want to reject it. We want to go somewhere where it's nice and comfy and warm. But when you really see that, we are inviting all conditions to be part of this practice or to be this practice. We are not rejecting anything. That's also extinguishing all thoughts. We are no longer attaching to those thoughts. They're just thoughts. They arise just like the breeze that is just coming through. Just like that. They just arise. And if we are not attaching, and we're not attaching other thoughts on top of the thoughts and on top of the thoughts, and we continue with our practice of mu, they will just dissipate. Thoughts arising, thoughts vanishing. Just comes and it goes. Just like the breeze. Comes and it goes. So that's one way of looking at completely extinguishing all thoughts of the ordinary mind. Now, those of us that sit with a very, very strong concentration, and those of us that can enter what they call the jhanas, the deep stages of samadhi, they will go into a realm where there are no thoughts. It's of course extremely blissful and extremely pleasurable. So you have these different ways of looking at it and these different ways of experiencing it. But ultimately, you know, it is not about extinguishing all thoughts, as in we've got to get to that point in meditation where there is no more thoughts and then all your problems will be gone, because it won't. You've just have an experience of no thoughts. But ultimately, no thoughts means no attachments to thoughts. And one sure way of doing that is by keeping on concentrating not just on mu, but remember what mu is. It's all. Whatever you're doing, concentrate. And the thoughts, they're background noise, just like the birds. They don't disturb. Now, in a previous koan, teisho, you know, the dogs were barking. We hear that quite often. And this is something that Ajahn Chah, which is famous Theravadan monk, has said once, and it really stuck with me, when someone was complaining about some external noise. And he said to that monk, I presume it was, stop disturbing the noise. Stop disturbing the noise. It's not the noise disturbing you. You are disturbing the noise. Stop disturbing the thoughts. You are disturbing the thoughts. Stop wanting it to be other than it is. You know, that's very powerful. That is getting out of the way. That is allowing, you know, allowing everything to unfold as it does anyway. Yeah. goes on, if you have not passed the barrier and have not extinguished all thoughts, you're a phantom haunting the weeds and the trees. In other words, you're like a ghost. You're like a ghost haunting the weeds and the trees. So you're the ghost haunting it, and it haunts you. And it's like that. It's like we're caught. And we want to desperately find an answer. We want to desperately get relief, whatever it is. We can't even name it. Of course, in some instances we can call it anxiety, but even then, what is it exactly when you start drilling into it? What is it? You know. Ultimately, if the barrier of mu is the key to really uproot it instead of managing it. Now just tell me, what is the barrier by the patriarchs? Merely this mu. Merely this mu. And the question is, what is mu? I mean, what is mu is a big question. Because mu is really what needs to be discovered. What is mu? So merely this mu. The one barrier of our sect. The one barrier. We say it's the one barrier, but remember what I said in the beginning. Every koan is mu, a mu koan. It's just different words are used. So the one barrier, it's just always comes back to it. Of course we say mu. I mean, it's just, that's just a label like all other labels are. Really got to discover this. The one barrier, merely this mu, the one barrier of the sect. It's the barrier of all barriers. It's the barrier of all religions, if you like, if you want to look at it from a spiritual perspective. Whatever we are seeking spiritually, that's the barrier, mu. Of course you can call it whatever you like. You can call it Holy Spirit, you can call it whatever. So it has to come. So it has come to be called the gateless barrier of our sect. Those who have passed the barrier are able not only to see Joshua face to face, but also to walk hand in hand with the whole descending line of patriarchs and be eyebrow to eyebrow with them. So first of all, not only to see Joshua face to face. If you see Mu, you see Joshua. If you see Mu, you see Buddha. If you see Mu, you see all. So this whole thing about patriarch or matriarchs or ancestors, all of that falls away. You see all, that's the whole thing, that's the whole idea. You will see eyebrow to eyebrow with them. In fact, you see them is, again, there's language. You know. You haven't got a choice but to be, that's why we say you've got to melt into it. You know, melt into it. You disappears. So this is a little bit dualistically explained. You will see with the same eye that they see with. Hear with the same ear that they hear with. So again, of course, language here can't really penetrate it. But the same, there's no such thing as same. Please get that. There's no such thing as same. Nothing is the same. Everything is everything all at once. You know, that is what needs to be discovered. Everything is everything all at once. But we say it like that because to us this way can make some sort of sense. But we can also get trapped in this. Wouldn't it be a wonderful joy? Isn't there anyone who wants to pass this barrier? Of course, we're here because we all want to pass this barrier. You know, over and over again, we want to pass this barrier. We want to clarify over and over again. Because even if we've had an experience, if we had a glimpse of it, you know, it dissipates. It eludes us. We get caught up in the phenomenal world. and it gets more and more difficult as we get caught up in it to be able to go back and reference that until it becomes a default situation. That's what we're all working towards. Then concentrate your whole self into this mu, making your whole body with 360 bones and joints and 84,000 pores into a solid lump of doubt. So, of course, it's an ancient way of describing our physiology, if you like, the 360 bones and the joints and the 84,000 pores into a solid lump of doubt. So what is this doubt? The doubt is nothing other than mu. That's the doubt. What's this mu? Day and night, without ceasing, keep digging into it. Now, normally in our day-to-day life, we don't do this unless you are a monk. And keep in mind, this is all written by monks, and this was very much a monastic tradition. So this is geared towards people that have doing this full time. Here we do this in a really concentrated way, only at a session. When we go back to our normal lives, it's very hard to fully concentrate on it because we get so caught up in our day-to-day life. But nevertheless, we can do this. And here you have an opportunity to practice this. Let go of everything else and just keep moving. Of course you will get distracted, like you do when you're sitting, but just come back to mu. Make an effort to just mu from the morning until you go to bed, and even as soon as you wake up, mu. And hopefully you dream of mu, nothing other but mu. Without ceasing, keep digging into it, but don't take it as nothingness or as being or non-being. As soon as we take it for nothingness, and this is a trap, as soon as we take it for nothingness, it becomes something. As soon as it becomes something, you know, then we call it nihilism or we give it a name. But there's we're selfing again. As soon as we do that, we are back where we started. It must be like a red hot iron ball which you have gulped down and which you try to vomit, but cannot. The best analogy I've heard of that is when you swallow a dumpling in a soup that is super hot, you can't swallow it, but you don't want to spit it out because it is so nice. You know, it's like you got this in there. So that's Mumon's way of saying it. It must be like a red hot iron ball which you have gulped down and which you try to vomit and cannot. I mean, that is some determination if you get to that stage. You know, that is some determination but Sesshin gives us the opportunity to do that, to really be determined. You know, we only have 2 days. I mean, what else are you going to do? You're going to be here anyway. You might as well fully engage in it, in the practice, and fully allow that to happen. You must extinguish all delusive thoughts and beliefs which you have cherished up to the present. This is a big one. You know, especially beliefs. We have all these strange beliefs. What about this? And what happens if I do this? And I don't really want to let go of self because there is self. And will I lose myself? What about this part? And it goes on and on and on and on. They're just thoughts, fears that we have. You must extinguish all delusive thoughts and beliefs. I remember once reading this part of a sutra, you know, if you want to find the truth, at the time I was into truth, if you want to find the truth, drop your opinions. Whoa, I remember this hitting me like you wouldn't believe. If you want to find the truth, drop your opinions. Now, what is left when you drop your opinions? You know. Of course, we come back to an opinion again. Yeah. So this is it. This is like, if you wanna find the truth, simply drop your opinions. And this is what he's saying. You must extinguish all delusive thoughts and beliefs which you have cherished up to the present. So your beliefs, you know, that's it. Your opinions, beliefs. And that doesn't mean that we are going to be without beliefs. I mean, you cannot be without beliefs. You know, we need beliefs in order to function. But to go beyond the beliefs, to go into a stage where we can see what they are, that's a functional aspect of our, you know, of who we really are. It's just a functional aspect of it. To see that, clearly see that, it puts on a completely different flavor. Beliefs all of a sudden, they loosen up. I have many beliefs. But to what degree am I so attached to them that I'd kill for them? Or even have an argument with someone about them? Our beliefs are so powerful. You must extinguish all delusive thoughts and beliefs which you have cherished up to the present. That's a really big one. After a certain period of such efforts, Mu will come to fruition. So, and this is it. Mu will come to fruition. The process is letting go. Mu will come to fruition. It's like saying, you'll see it. It's there. It's always in fruition. It's always accessible. All of a sudden, we start seeing it. We don't have to do anything except letting go of our beliefs. Oh, is it this? Let it go. Maybe I'm doing this wrong. Let that go. I mean, it cannot be simpler than what else is there? It cannot be simpler, and we make it so complicated. Inside and out will become one naturally. Inside is a belief. Outside is a belief. We're stuck in definitions. It's just a definition, inside and outside. That's all it is. It's just a definition that someone came up with, said, okay, in another language it's another word. But no, there's an inside, and no, there's an outside. And there's a bird, and there's a me, and there's a you, and these are all definitions that we are holding on to. They become one naturally, all. You will then be like a dumb man who has had a dream. You can't speak it. Once you've had it, it's, what are you going to say? Because all reference points will melt away. There's nothing to hold on to. They will all fall away. You will know yourself for yourself only. This comes back to all. You will know yourself, your small self, for yourself. Yourself only, yourself, your big self only. There's just all. So you'll know yourself for yourself. Like this comes back to I alone. There's just alone. Alone meaning no other. Nothing other than it, whatever words we use. You will know yourself for yourself only. Then all of a sudden, Mu will break open. It will astonish the heavens and shake the earth. It will be just as if you had snatched the great sword of General Khan. So that's the great sword of General Khan, as most of you would know, is a mythical sword that is believed to have existed in with General Khan, and the mythology is that no matter when he went into battle, as soon as he had his sword, that he was invincible. He would always win any type of battle. So it goes back to ancient China. So it will be just as if you had snatched it. And of course, you could never snatch it from the general. He was invincible. So now all of a sudden it says, when you see this, you just snatch that sword. And when you see a Buddha, or if you meet a Buddha, you will kill him. If you will meet a Buddha, you will kill him. So here, of course, it doesn't mean literally kill the Buddha. It means you kill all concepts that are preventing you from seeing Buddha, from seeing all. So as soon as there is a Buddha there, it's no longer all. There's me and a Buddha. As soon as you see anything there, a patriarch, a teacher, the Dharma, the teaching, you go along and you slay it all. Why? Because it's all. How can it be any separate? How can there be anything separate? If you meet a patriarch, you will kill him. Though you may stand on the brink of life and death, you will enjoy great freedom. So life and death does no longer come into it. What is life? What is death? So that is no longer a consideration, life and death. Again, this is, I mean, life and death, I can give a whole teisho on this, and I've talked about it many times. I won't do it right now. But this is the freedom. This is the freedom that this is talked about, you know, this life and death freedom. It's one of the biggest fears that we have is dying, you know, the self. But if there's all, if you realize allness, How can there be life and how can there be death? How can there be birth? It's all. It's a continuous cycle. In the six realms and the four modes of birth, so these are the different Buddhist realms, the six realms. You know, there are the god realms and human realms and the demigod realms and the animal realms and the ghost realms. And the hell realms, so the six realms. You know. So depending on beliefs, and in ancient times they believed in these different realms, and even still today some people believe in these different realms. But whether you believe in them or not is irrelevant. Doesn't matter which way, like from a perspective of allness, we are continuously reborn. Everything is continuously recycled. Nothing disappears. And nothing appears. Because it's all. No single individual thing. You know, it looks that way to us. We perceive it that way, of course. But this is what that means. If you, in the six realms and the four modes of birth, meaning the different stages of birth, like we might be birthed through the womb, or you know, you might get birthed through eggs, and then they had other ones like transcendent birth and various other births in ancient times. You will live in the samadhi of innocent play. You know, that will no longer occupy you. That will no longer be a fear. It's another way of looking at that. You will play in the samadhi of innocent play. Now, how should you concentrate on Mu? Exhaust every ounce of energy you have in doing it. And if you do not give up on the way, you will be enlightened the way a candle in front of the altar is lighted by one touch of fire. Just like that. So it's a great invitation to practice and fully concentrate on Mu. So this is a commentary by Mumon, a very famous commentary. And then he wrote a verse. So this is a very, quite a beautiful verse. By the way, Mumon, the originator, the author of the collection of these koans, he worked on Mu for 6 years before he fully penetrated Mu. As a monastic, so he would have worked day and night, as in that would have been his full-time purpose. you know, didn't have family, didn't have worries of life and making a living and all of that. That Mu would have been his, and he worked, you know, for 6 years to get to that point. So he chose Mu from then on as the first koan in the collection, and then from then on various other masters used Mu as a breakthrough koan. In other words, that is the one we must penetrate in order to move on to the next koan. We've got to have some sort of a reference point, some sort of an experience in order to move on to the next koan. Now, it doesn't really matter whether what koan you use as a first koan. It's just that Mumon used this one here, and a lot of other traditions, including ours, have followed this path. So he wrote the verse, and the verse is a literary exercise that was used in ancient China to, you know, through poetry, and poetry is a language in itself, through poetry to get to the heart of the matter, to really point to what Mu is all about. And this verse, I feel, is really powerful, and, you know, it's also a koan. So once we get to the stage of working on this, once you get to the Mumon Khan, then this verse becomes a koan. And it goes like this. Dog, Buddha nature. Anto, cushion. Soon there'll be lunch. The perfect manifestation, the absolute command. A little has or has not. Body is lost, life is lost.